What North Koreans are hearing about the Trump-Kim summit today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North Korean media is usually full of anti-American bombast, but as we've been approaching next week's planned summit, that's not been the case.
The tone of the coverage of the United States in general has changed a lot in the last couple of months.
Also, Trump holds a dinner to observe the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, but he doesn't invite American Muslims to the White House, only foreign diplomats.
I think it just reinforces what his policy has been all along, which is to, again, ignore American Muslims. And then I think it's also part of a broader mission to kind of foreignize Islam and foreignize Muslims.
Those stories and more coming up here today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Thanks for being with us today. Donald Trump has taken more than a few meetings in his lifetime, but now as president and with the world watching, he's taking what has to be one of the most consequential meetings of his life. Of course, I'm talking about his plan face-to-face with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. It's scheduled for June 12th in Singapore. Today, Trump said the summit is all ready to go. Easy to say, but there's a whole lot at stake. This is a decades-long standoff between the U.S. and North Korea, and now there are North Korean nukes involved. We wanted to know what, if anything, people in North Korea are hearing about the big meeting. So we reached out to Peter Ward. He's based in Seoul and keeps a close eye on all things North Korea for the site nknews.org. Ward was recently in North Korea's capital, Pyongyang, and he got to see firsthand how the run-up to the summit is being covered by the news media there.
There is Korean Central TV. There are a couple of other TV stations, but that's the main one. And there is also Rodong Shinmun, a newspaper of the ruling Korean Workers' Party. And then there are a couple of other newspapers. They also have regional newspapers. So obviously you're going to have regional news in your regional newspapers. Your national newspapers are going to focus on the nation at large. But they all speak with one voice, and that voice says, Kim Jong-un is fantastic, he's great, and he's a wonderful statesman, and he is leading the Korean Peninsula and the North Korean people on a path of peace with the international community, as it were.
And that is pretty much the sole message. I mean, North Koreans are not getting other news sources externally via the internet or anything like that.
There are clandestine ways to access foreign media in North Korea. You can listen to Radio Free Asia broadcasts or broadcasts of North Korean defectors who record programs and broadcast into North Korea. There are also balloons. So some South Korean-based activists send balloons into North Korea with information attached to them.
Wow.
Yes. There's also some smuggling that goes on, which includes smuggling of information across the border into North Korea.
What are the consequences for North Koreans who listen to that media being broadcast from the South by defectors?
Depends how much money they've got. If you've got a lot of money, you can usually bribe your way out of criminal charges. If you don't, you can go to prison for quite some time.
So before we get to the coverage about Trump and Kim's summit, I just want to clarify one thing, because I've heard that there are trucks sometimes with loudspeakers blasting North Korean news or propaganda. They travel from town to town. I've also heard described a system where many homes in North Korea have a radio loudspeaker with no volume and no on-off switch. And every now and then a presenter comes on with some announcement from Pyongyang. Can you confirm either of those two?
The second one, I think, is very important. It's the internal radio system, which they use to announce things that are not for foreign audiences to find out about. So, for instance, there was a currency reform in 2009, and that was announced over the internal radio system. But my understanding is that internal radio system, you can't turn it off, but you can turn the volume down. The vans going up and down the countryside and in the cities, yes, that is a thing, but I'm not sure how often those are out and about. I was in Pyongyang a couple of weeks ago. I didn't see any.
So the upcoming summit between Trump and Kim, is that something North Koreans are hearing about, reading about, seeing on state-run media, and is it a regular thing right now?
The summit, it gets mentioned. It's not a secret, but it's not discussed much, and the politics that surround it are not extensively covered in the newspapers. So if you open up your North Korean newspapers or you watch North Korean TV, you see mainly right now a lot of economic news. That is the priority in the propaganda right now, domestic propaganda.
Now, among the events related to the Trump-Kim summit that have been covered by state TV in North Korea are the two trips that now Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made to the North, where he met with Kim Jong-un. Here's a little sound of that coverage. the tone of the presenter here and the music, I mean, it's jovial, it's triumphant. Is that an accurate read? And is there a typical way the North Koreans kind of treat U.S. stories?
Absolutely. That's an accurate read, and it's very unusual. You know, the average story about America is about the American people's resistance to Donald Trump or the evil war machinations of the U.S. imperialists in South Korea. American leaders are basically never presented in a positive light, ever. And the fact that, you know, Kim Jong-un is with Pompeo, they're smiling, they're laughing, they're getting along, and that's presented is interesting. It's very interesting.
Has the way Trump is being presented on North Korean state media, has that changed as well in recent weeks?
Basically, there have not been many references to Trump at all in the last couple of weeks. He's just basically disappeared from the newspapers.
And what were the references beforehand about?
He's a warmongering dotard, you know, a crazy senile old man was the one that was used late last year. But more recently, just, yes, a warmonger. But the tone of the coverage of the United States in general has changed a lot in the last couple of months.
So seemingly little coverage of the summit in North Korea, but what details have been kind of brought out in the little coverage that you have seen?
So the summit is to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. Kim Jong-un is playing the active role in that happening. And it was the Americans who asked for the summit, not the North Koreans, according to North Korean propaganda.
Right.
And the summit is not for economic reasons. The North is not going to America supplicating with a begging bowl. Rather, it is looking to make peace and to bring about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is their term for whatever they want, whatever they end up agreeing.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to give up their nukes. It just is a word that they're using right now.
Right. It's just, it could be code for anything. It's very unclear what they mean. And I think that's the idea.
But basically, you do sense that the North Korean media are saying this is a moment for peace.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Peter Ward, a writer for nknews.org. He spoke with us from Seoul, South Korea. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Trump White House broke with tradition last year when it took a pass on hosting an iftar dinner. That's the evening meal to break the fast during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton all hosted iftars during Ramadan. Then a few days ago, the Trump administration said it would do the same this year. The dinner was last night, but conspicuously absent from the invite list were Muslim Americans. Zaki Barzinji is an advisor to the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Before that, he was in the Obama White House as Senior Associate Director of Public Engagement and the President's Liaison to Muslim Americans. So when the Trump White House first announced that an iftar dinner would be held, there weren't really any details about who was invited. At the time, Zaki, what was your reaction to the news?
My initial reaction was I had a feeling that this is exactly the direction that the administration would take, that if they were going to do a iftar after having nixed it last year, they probably were only going to invite people from the diplomatic corps. It was very unlikely that they'd invite any actual American Muslim leaders. And if they did, it was very unlikely that that many American Muslim leaders would actually go in the first place. So I had an inkling when they first heard about this that it was going to be mostly diplomats.
So what kind of statement does having an iftar dinner with just diplomats but no Muslim Americans, what kind of statement does that send?
I think it just reinforces what his policy has been all along, which is to ignore American Muslims here in this country, even though we have the most diverse representation of Muslims in the world, and instead focus on foreign governments from the so-called Muslim world who he thinks can forge strategic ties. There's definitely trade interests involved. And then I think it's also part of a broader mission to kind of foreignize Islam and foreignize Muslims in the sense that even when Trump is doing positive engagement with these countries, he still is highlighting, especially countries like Saudi Arabia, as being the proper representation of Muslims. And the idea that there aren't American Muslims or Muslims aren't integrated into the U.S. So every time he does this, when he focuses on just Muslims in other lands, it only cements and underscores that same message.
I mean, there's some obvious irony with the ban on travel from certain Muslim-majority countries, and yet when it comes to Muslim Americans, they don't get the invitation to the iftar dinner at the White House. I mean, is that something you saw as well?
Yeah, for sure. I think the only time the Muslim American community hears from the administration is when he's in the middle of enacting a policy that directly targets and marginalizes our community. And again, that's taken the form of the Muslim ban. It's taken the form of the rhetoric from the president himself and many of his senior advisors who have come directly from organizations, institutions that kind of peddle Islamophobic conspiracies on a full-time basis. So you know, the American Muslim community is very familiar with the type of outreach that the president has done, in the sense that it hasn't been any outreach to American Muslims. It's all been fear mongering and policies that directly target us.
I mean, given the travel ban, do you know if any of the diplomats did not go in protest?
From what I understand, at least a few of the countries that were technically part of the ban did still send their ambassadors to the iftar. And look at it from their perspective, you know, I don't blame anybody from the diplomatic community that went and attended this program, because for them, showing up to an event like this with the president sometimes is the only chance they have to have any audience with him whatsoever.
I mean, in that sense, isn't this iftar dinner at the White House under previous presidents as well? Wasn't it mostly symbolic?
It's always been a symbolic event, but there is still power in that symbolism. President Obama for 7 years had a White House iftar with about 100 people, but it was always an even mix of diplomats and actual Muslim American leaders. The message that comes out of that is the Obama administration prioritized engagement with the Muslim world just as much as they prioritized engagement with the American Muslim community. And the president, in every speech he gave that talked about Muslims, he always made sure to emphasize the longstanding nature of American Muslim presence in this country. It would always say American Muslims have been a part of the nation's fabric since before its founding. They have contributed to society in every single way imaginable. Yeah, they're symbolic phrases, but this president hasn't even done that bare minimum. He hasn't acknowledged in any way, in any capacity, contributions from American Muslims in any context or even the existence of American Muslims. So when President Trump spoke for 4 minutes last night at the White House iftar, it was all about how he enjoyed his trip to Saudi Arabia and how he wanted to have better relationships with the Middle East. But there were zero mentions of American Muslim community even existing.
So do you think if President Trump had invited Muslim Americans, would they have gone? Would you have gone?
Yeah, it's a fair question. You know, a lot of people have been saying, well, isn't it good that he had an iftar and invited diplomatic corps? If he had invited American Muslims, what would they have even done? Would they have even showed up? And I think that just the simple action of him inviting American Muslims wouldn't have been enough to allay the concerns that this community has with this administration, because every other policy that he's enacted has directly targeted and marginalized American Muslims. So I wouldn't blame any American Muslim leader who did get invited to decline that invitation, because I think there's a certain calculus you have to make, which is, does my participation in an event like this equal becoming an endorser of this president's policies? And from that perspective, first of all, I don't think I would have ever gotten invited in the first place. But if I did, I don't think I would have gone. And I think it's not a black and white thing. I think with the Obama iftars, you did have Muslim leaders who came to attend who had stridently different views from the Obama administration even. But they at least felt like the lines of communication were open and there was enough sincerity in the outreach on behalf of the Obama administration that they still felt like they should show up. This administration hasn't done nearly any groundwork or legwork to give those same assurances. And so therefore, I wouldn't blame anybody for getting invited and refusing that invitation.
At the end of the day, would you have preferred if Trump just didn't hold any iftar dinner at all like last year?
Yeah, I mean, I'd prefer he end his Islamophobic policies more than anything else.
Right.
But yeah, I think for as long as he's going to continue along the same path, as long as he's going to erase the existence and the needs and the contributions of American Muslims, I don't think it makes sense to hold an iftar that doesn't even recognize his own constituents. So yeah, maybe it would have been better for him to just stay with his own tradition that he started last year of not holding an iftar at all.
Zaki Barzinji is an advisor to the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Zaki, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Just ahead on the show, a real estate sign from New Jersey washed up recently on a beach in France. The backstory featuring Hurricane Sandy coming up right here on The World. Hurricane Sandy, 2012. It killed dozens of people and caused billions of dollars in damage as it churned from the Caribbean right up the East Coast and all the way into Canada. New Jersey was hit hard. That's where Diane Turton lives and works. She runs a real estate company based in Point Pleasant Beach, New Jersey. Recently, she got an email from a guy named Hans Frank saying he found one of her company's for sale signs on a beach near Bordeaux, France. The sign went missing 5.5 years ago when Sandy hit.
First, I thought it was a joke when I got the email. So once it was all verified, then we posted it on Facebook and then everything went crazy. Because what are the chances of a man walking down the beach and seeing it and taking it home and Googling my name and telling me that he had our sign in France?
Tell me about your story during Sandy. What were you doing? What do you recall of the storm and how crazy was it?
We were right in the brunt of it. In fact, my two sons took a boat. My one son's a photographer and got there before the National Guard the morning after. And it was utter destruction. He saved pets coming out of houses and people. The house is broken half and just floated out to sea. One listing that we had for $5.3 million was supposed to close that Monday at 1 o'clock. And the house literally broke in half and half went out in the Atlantic Ocean.
So a $5 million home just sucked out into the ocean.
$10 million homes got sucked out. People couldn't believe it. It almost looked like a war zone that somebody had bombed us. So now 5.5 years go by and this sign was not on an oceanfront house. It was like on a creek. So it had to go out and around these little jetties to even get out to the Atlantic Ocean, to get across to Bordeaux. That's what was even more ironic. It wasn't just a direct out of the ocean house. It was nestled back amongst lagoons and everything, and it went out that way and then across.
So going from the tragedy of Sandy and then this news about this real estate sign showing up in France, I mean, it's really yin and yang. Did it provide you some sense of closure to Sandy?
Yes, it did. It brought back all the horrific memories that we had of everything. But also, it gave kind of peace that just like message in a bottle, and the guy in Bordeaux didn't even know that it was from Sandy. He just found the real estate sign and figured, oh my gosh, this is from New Jersey. They'd probably love to hear that a sign floated across the ocean and came to France. And we're flying there. I'm flying with my husband and my marketing guru to pick up the sign, meet Hans. Fantastic. And then I'm going to bring the sign back. In fact, yesterday a museum called and they want to borrow the sign in their venue that they're doing on Sandy. They've collected a lot of things and they heard about the sign and they called us.
What a great end to the story. So years from now, when people walk through that museum in New Jersey and they see that real estate sign from your real estate agency, what do you want them to think? What do you want to occur to them?
I just want them to think that, look, that was a tragedy that happened, 5.5 years ago. It's a remembrance of something that we all went through, but we got through, and everybody worked together to get everybody back on their feet. I don't know. It was a happy moment that the sign came, and we could remember all the good that came out of what happened 5.5 years ago.
Diane Turton, head of Diane Turton Realtors in New Jersey. Thanks very much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And speaking of long ocean crossings, we're going to hear now from musician Tammy Nielsen. She was born in Canada, but she's been calling New Zealand home for a decade now. As part of our project Across Women's Lives, Nielsen spoke to us about her latest album and the three key moments that inspired it.
My new album is called Sassafras, which means a sassy person who speaks their mind. And it was inspired by, I guess, three things in my life that happened in the last few years. I lost a parent. I became a parent. I turned 40. And those three things really change your perspective. You suddenly don't put so much value on the judgments and criticisms of others. And it's a real celebration of freedom. Your head is shaking. Your mouth is frowning. The first track on Sassafras is called Stay Out of My Business. Your elbows nudging. All the poison that you spread with these nasty words you say. Stay out of my business. 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 Leave it alone. The only business you got is your own. It's become a bit of an anthem of sorts. It was taken from some experiences that happened to me being a touring musician and a mother. And I'd never really encountered sexism and misogyny with such full force as when I dared to be both a mom and continued to be a touring musician. And on tour, I'd have people coming up to me saying, who's looking after your children? And how can you leave them? And I was just crushed by this guilt. And then realized, life is too short and I'm providing an amazing role model for my boys, a hardworking, passionate person. I'm never going to have to say to my boys, follow your dreams, because they're watching me do it every day. Skeletons rattle inside. Dark and dirty closets need the Hollywood sign. This next track off of the album is called Smoking Gun, and it was written the week that the sexual misconduct allegations started to roll out of Hollywood and sparking the incredible Me Too movement. And this song in particular is about a certain Hollywood producer who's recently been arrested.
Well, there's a predator creeping in the pool. The king of the casting couch where he rules. Golden boy has started to crack. Squirming like a worm under a magnifying glass. The smoking gun.
Sassafras definitely leans toward a very retro, nostalgic feel. And I guess that's just because that's the music that I immerse myself in. I am a huge fan of Sharon Jones. I was deeply saddened when we lost her. And I felt like I had deeply connected with her when I saw the documentary, Miss Sharon Jones. I particularly remember a scene where she's on the cover of a magazine and she starts to cry because she says, I wish that my mom was here to see this. I deeply connected with that. I had just lost my dad and all these achievements that happen after you lose someone. There's a small element of emptiness and wanting to share it with them. And then she talked about how she was told she was too fat, she was too old, she was too black. And having been told, you know, two out of three of those things, it really resonated with me. And the last song that I'd like to play for you today is called Miss Jones. Her resilience is something that I just wanted to capture and celebrate in this song.
I'm Marco Werman. Plastic bags and plastic straws, it turns out, are a global threat. The reason?
There's a growing realization around the world that we're just using so much plastic, it's starting to overrun our environment. In fact, just this week, news emerged that microplastics have been found in the oceans near Antarctica.
That story is still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's clear something up. It's not illegal to enter the U.S. without papers if you're asking for asylum. That's how the asylum process works. It's designed to protect people who can't go home because of a well-founded fear of persecution. That fear could be based on nationality, religion, or membership in a particular social group, among other things. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions is thinking about changing the way immigration judges would grant asylum. As Beth Fertig of WNYC reports, such a change could have a big impact on many types of cases, especially women claiming to be victims of domestic violence.
The photos on Naomi's cell phone tell a gruesome story. The 23-year-old mother shows me the shriveled and discolored skin on her son's left hand.
That's what it looks like today?
Así es que se ve hoy en día.
Sí. Así se ve la mano ahorita.
That's how you see his hand right now.
Naomi says her son suffered third-degree burns when her former boyfriend threw a pot of hot oil at her, but it scalded her son instead. This happened back in Honduras when her child was four. She asked us not to use her real name in order to protect her identity while she seeks asylum.
Es algo que yo me voy a acordar toda mi vida. Y también me voy a sentir culpable. Yo me siento culpable.
Naomi says she'll feel guilty about it for the rest of her life. Her son's injuries were so serious, she says, he spent 6 months in hospitals recovering from infections and skin grafts on his hand, arm, and back. Afterwards, Naomi describes how the man who'd beaten and sexually assaulted her returned.
Ese día él llegó con una pistola.
That day he showed up with a gun.
Naomi's attorney, Michelle Martinez, translates her account.
Amenazando mi mamá y tratando de llevarme a la fuerza con él.
He was threatening my mother. He was demanding that I go back with him or else.
Naomi says she fled and eventually made it to New York. She couldn't bring her son because of his fragile medical state, but she planned to retrieve him after winning asylum. It's taking a while, largely because the immigration courts are so busy. But now, after 5 years in the U.S., her dream of staying here may be in jeopardy because of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He's considering whether to restrict asylum for people like Naomi. Here he is on Phoenix radio station KTAR recently.
We've had situations in which a person comes to the United States and says they are a victim of domestic violence. Therefore, they're entitled to enter the United States. Well, that's obviously false, but some judges have gone along with that.
Sessions has stated that domestic violence cases involve private criminal activity by individuals, questioning whether they're the same as more typical asylum cases involving government persecution. But immigration lawyers say that's missing the point. Domestic violence victims can currently win protection because they're considered members of a particular social group, women who are attacked but can't get help from their governments. Naomi claims she did call the police in Honduras about her boyfriend's abuse, but they wouldn't take her reports. Her attorney, Michelle Martinez, says that's common in countries where the authorities are controlled by gangs and drug dealers.
She did suffer domestic violence from a horrific individual, but the police in her country did nothing to protect her.
As Attorney General, Sessions can't change U.S. asylum law on his own, but he can change how judges determine who qualifies because he controls the immigration courts. They're part of the Justice Department, making the Attorney General kind of like the U.S. Supreme Court. If he personally rules on a case, then all immigration judges have to follow his precedent. Sessions is now poised to make a ruling on a domestic violence case very similar to Naomi's. More than 100,000 asylum cases were filed nationally in the last fiscal year. There's no breakdown for how many involved domestic violence, but Brian Johnson, an immigration lawyer on Long Island, says they wouldn't be the only ones affected.
If Jeff Sessions changed the law to say that nobody could, who was a victim of private criminal activity, can qualify for asylum, it would disqualify over 90% of our clients from asylum, and they would have nothing else to fall on.
Johnson also represents LGBTQ clients who were beaten because of their sexual identity and those coerced into joining gangs. He says they'd all be sent back to near certain death. Asylum is tough to win, and the outcome of a case can also depend a lot on individual judges and jurisdictions. William Van Wyk was an immigration judge in New York who granted asylum more than 80% of the time.
I felt a legal obligation as a judge to hear the human being behind the words that were being spoken and literally to empathize.
Van Wyk says it also helps that immigrants in New York usually get lawyers, something that's rare in other cities with fewer resources. But even with a good lawyer, Van Wyk says every case is challenging.
This person may be sincere in telling from the heart what they lived through, or the person may be echoing what some friend of theirs said in a successful case, or what they heard from somebody they ought to say.
Sorting that out takes time, he says, which is why he opposes any effort by Attorney General Sessions to bluntly limit who qualifies for asylum. If Sessions does impose restrictions, an immigrant could take their case to federal court, but the Attorney General is changing the immigration courts in other ways. He's already made it harder for some immigrants to get asylum hearings to begin with, and he's also planning a quota system to make immigration judges work faster. For the World, Beth Fertig, New York.
So Naomi from Honduras is waiting to hear how Attorney General Jeff Sessions will rule. The question before him is whether victims of domestic violence qualify for asylum.
We submitted an amicus brief at the invitation of the Attorney General.
Michael Heffman is an attorney with the Immigration Reform Law Institute. That's a D.C.-based law firm which, according to its website, quote, exists to defend the rights of individual Americans and their local communities from the harms and challenges posed by mass migration to the United States.
The brief stated essentially what we have been arguing over this issue, which has been a political one within the government going back and forth at least since 1999, that domestic violence is a crime and private criminal activity has never been considered to constitute persecution or to form the legal definition of a refugee, which is what this individual must do in order to qualify for asylum in the United States.
And why have you taken that position? Why not see domestic abuse as a kind of a larger symptom?
It can't fit in within the internationally recognized definition of a refugee, which is not simply anyone suffering harm of some kind. It's a very particular definition. They have to be suffering from race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or this other rather amorphous group called membership in a particular social group. If they can't establish that, they're not a refugee and they don't qualify for asylum. And in this case, I can't see how this individual who, as you say, has suffered a heinous crime at the hand of a boyfriend, not even a spouse, so to speak, simply doesn't fit in that category.
There are going to be a lot of Americans who disagree with you and see your views as even inhumane. It's also clear a lot of Americans agree with you. So do you see kind of a higher purpose to kind of your view of immigration, and what is that goal?
Our goal is a sustainable immigration policy, which recognizes in environmental terms, both social and physical, the carrying capacity of the United States, and does not sacrifice that capacity to the failures of other sovereign states in areas regarding the quality of life, legal treatment, their own environmental sustainability, et cetera, et cetera. It's simply even if you were, for argument's sake, to characterize it as inhumane, even if all of the solutions that advocates of this much more liberalized policy were in place, it would really make no quantitative difference in ameliorating the suffering and the Hobbesian conditions in these ascending countries.
You don't think a woman that's sent back and facing the possibility, the very real possibility that her boyfriend might throw hot oil on her to send her away, that's a humane thing?
It's neither humane or inhumane. If she had every opportunity to establish that she, even if she didn't qualify for asylum, for example, she could claim withholding of removal, in which she merely has to establish the probability that her life, that she would be subject to a threat to her life or a severe physical injury. And evidently, she hasn't even met this very low standard.
There are many other cases of people who have returned and have lost their lives. I mean, it's not a unique case.
I would respectfully disagree with that. This is a debating point that I bring up when I meet in public fora with members of immigrants' rights and open borders groups, and I say, please direct me to the list of individuals whose asylum claims have been rejected by the United States and have returned and then suffered cognizable persecution. In other words, that there was an error and that they really were a refugee. And I have yet to see one of those lists.
Well, I find that striking because I've heard dozens of stories. Anyway, you've commented in the past about the demographic shift that will turn the U.S. into a so-called majority-minority country by the middle of this century, in which previous minority groups will constitute the majority of the U.S. population. How do you feel about the prospect of that majority-minority country?
How do I feel about it?
Yes.
Well, it's irrelevant what I feel about it if we don't have a sustainable immigration policy in place, because demographic change in the United States, at least since the 1970s, has been driven primarily by immigration into the country rather than natural increase of the existing population in the country itself. And I don't know of any other country, sovereign state, society on the planet where that has occurred peacefully, routinely, voluntarily, without massive conflict, suffering the effects of war and civil conflict.
What do you think is different about this demographic shift as opposed to, say, the mass immigration of Italians and Irish and Poles and Jewish people in the late part of the 19th, early 20th century? What's different today?
It's essentially a question of numbers. The number of persons who are entering the country related to the capacity of the receiving nation to absorb them is as I said, it's impossible to accommodate the demand.
You turned 18 in about 1972, I see, draft age. The Vietnam War was on. Where were you at the time?
I left the United States before I turned 17.
Did you leave intentionally to avoid the draft?
Yes.
And where did you go?
England.
So
I was born in England.
You were born in England. So
yes, my father was a graduate exchange student.
So in a way, you benefited from migration.
Yes, I did.
Isn't there some hypocrisy there?
No. Persons who come to the United States on graduate exchange program and have children here, those children become United States citizens. It's a perfectly uniform rule.
Michael Heffman with the Immigration Reform Law Institute in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Before we go to the break, here's a preview of a guest we'll have on tomorrow's show, a woman who first became famous in Iran after she was photographed running down the street with her hair uncovered. Now she's an outspoken advocate for the rights of Iranian women, and the thing she's focusing on is the headscarf.
When we fight against compulsory hijab, we are not fighting against a piece of cloth. We are fighting for our dignity. We are fighting for our identity. And I always get misunderstood by the media in the West. They're saying that, you know, you're causing Islamophobia. I want to just invite all the women to join us because, you know, being the voice of those women who are fighting against the discriminatory law, that doesn't make you Islamophobic. These are the restrictive laws, the Sharia laws, which, you know, causing Islamophobia, not the women of Iran who are fighting against discriminatory laws.
Masih Alinejad's fight for Iranian women to take control of their hair, their clothing, and their lives. She's a compelling speaker. You'll hear her tomorrow right here.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
That priceless plastic moment from The Graduate. Plastics is going to be our word for the next few minutes. I'm joined by the world's livable planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler. We're seeing plastics taking a pretty big hit lately, Carolyn. What's going on?
Marco, there's a growing realization around the world that we're just using so much plastic, it's starting to overrun our environment. It's killing whales because they're eating it. It's blocking drains and creating habitats for mosquitoes. It's breaking apart into tiny little microplastics that work their way into our food and water. In fact, just this week, news emerged that microplastics have been found in the oceans near Antarctica.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're in sort of a watershed moment where governments are starting to pass laws or taxes on plastic bags and other sort of single-use plastic items. So, for example, this week India announced it would ban single-use plastics. Chile is starting to phase out plastic bags in grocery stores. And even IKEA today announced they were going to stop using single-use plastics. So this is all good news for the environment.
But it also sounds like there's some bad news, too.
Right. So there's a new UN report out this week showing that in the more than 60 countries that have passed these types of laws, taxes or bans on plastic bags, of the countries where there's enough data to analyze how well they're working, only a little more than half of these laws are having a good effect on plastics.
Okay. So in the places where those laws are having an effect, do we know what makes them work or not?
Well, it looks like good enforcement and good cheap alternatives to plastic bags are a key factor. In the places where those bans aren't working, they don't have those. And I can give you a couple of examples. So South Africa passed a ban on regular thin grocery bags back
right.
in 2003 and a tax on thicker ones. And people eventually just worked that tax into their food budget. So the plastic bag use didn't go down overall in the long run. On the flip side, recently on the Caribbean island of Antigua, they recently passed a plastic bag ban. But before that, they had this huge outreach campaign and they handed out reusable plastic bags. And that's actually reduced the plastic amount in landfills by 15%.
Wow.
So countries are starting to look around and see sort of what works and what doesn't.
All right, Carolyn, please sit tight, if you would, while we take a look at how this plastics business is playing out in one country, Kenya. We talked about Kenya's plastic bag ban here on the show when it took effect last August. It was the harshest in the world, with a roughly $40,000 penalty for anyone caught selling or using plastic bags. There's not enough data yet to tell empirically how well it's working, but we thought we'd get the perspective on the ground from our BBC colleague, Ferdinand Omondi, in Kenya. So have you noticed a difference on Nairobi streets since this ban on plastic bags took effect?
Actually, around the country in major towns, there was plastic bags everywhere you could look. There was a very poor disposal system in the city. The trash cans used to be quite filled. And the plastic bags were the main method by which Kenyans carry everything from groceries to school bags. And so the streets used to look pretty bad at this time last year. But ever since the ban, you can actually see much cleaner streets, at least no plastic bags around. So certainly a very significant change, and not so much of an eyesore, the streets of Nairobi.
That's pretty encouraging. But I know plastic bag producers tried unsuccessfully to sue and stop this ban last summer. How did people react when it actually went into effect?
Initially, it was frustrating for many Kenyans because, as I mentioned, people only knew how to use plastic bags from nearly everything. The woman would go to the market to buy groceries needed plastic bags. The mechanic who went to his workshop carried most of his tools in a heavy plastic bag. Students or pupils would carry their bags to school in plastic bags. People did not know exactly how they would operate without them. And the other thing is that the recyclable bags were about 5-10 times more expensive than the cheapest plastic bags, and this is the kind of money that most of the people who live on less than a dollar a day could not afford. So initially there was some sort of resistance, but when the government showed it meant business, people started slowly adjusting to it. And right now I can tell you there's very little complaint about the use of bags because people are saying, hey, it actually works and we are surviving without it.
Yeah, so when people go to the market, what do they carry with them?
Now, there are recyclable bags, but they are reusable. So a lot of people, you go to the supermarket and now you have to buy this for yourself. Before, the traders would give you the plastic bags for free, but now, since these ones are a bit expensive, you have to buy it and then you keep it at home. Now, the problem with this is that a lot of people forget to carry these recyclable bags when they go to the supermarkets. So it means that every time they go to shop, they have to buy 2 or 3 plastic bags to carry the groceries home. And some people, including myself, we have cabinets full of the recyclable bags. It's a bit difficult, but people are managing, and they're largely happy with it.
Yeah, I know that cabinet. We've got one of our own at the house. The thing is, small plastic bags used to be used for basically everything. I mean, you've kind of alluded to that in small markets, from portions of rice to cut up fruit. In South Africa, they jokingly call the plastic bag the national flower because there were so many on the ground. It may be funny, but not to vendors, I would imagine, who want to accommodate their buyers with a bag to take away their stuff. How are the vendors dealing with this?
It's a bit tricky for especially those cut fruit vendors, those who sell small pieces of sugarcane or cut up mangoes and oranges, because it was the plastic bags which are most convenient. So there have been attempts by some of them, especially in the informal areas, to smuggle some of these bags. And indeed, the authorities have been conducting operations in such areas to impound these bags and probably take these people to court. In the more middle-class areas, it is no longer a problem. They have been able to afford the heavier containers, which are still legal, but it's a bit of a cat and mouse, especially in the informal settlements.
It sounds like this ban on plastic bags kind of signifies a permanent change in Kenya. Would you agree with that?
That is true. This is permanent. I do not think there are any signs that Kenya will be going back. The next step for the central government, they announced, was just to try and clean up the rivers and also some of the huge rubbish mounds. But as it stands in Kenya, plastic bags are history.
BBC reporter Ferdinand Omondi there in Nakuru, Kenya. And back to Carolyn Beeler again with our Livable Planet desk. Most of the laws passed around the world, Carolyn, are about plastic bags per se, but that's not the biggest source of plastic litter or even trash, right? So any tips on using less plastic overall?
It's kind of daunting to think about, but I think what's helpful to think about is that roughly half the plastic waste around the world is from packaging. So if you start focusing on that, that can help you tackle a big part of your plastic footprint.
So we all know about bringing our reusable bags to the grocery store now. What else can we do?
Well, again, I think it's helpful to know what are the biggest culprits when it comes to plastic waste. So there's this list of items that are most found in coastal cleanups around the world. Cigarette butts top that list by mass, but then the rest is largely food packaging. Plastic bottles and caps, food wrappers, grocery bags, straws and stirrers, and takeout containers. So if you think about those items and think about how you can bring your own reusable versions of them and try to say no to things you don't need, like maybe a coffee cup lid or a straw or a stirrer, that can get you to start thinking about plastic as something not to take for granted.
The World's Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
By the way, if you want a visual of what our plastic consumption is doing to our waters around the globe, we have a video from Indonesia where you can see entire rivers filled with plastic pollution. You can watch that at PRI.org. And that's where we're going to leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.